Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Grok Radio. The following broadcast is made possible by the friends and partners of CYI Worldwide Ministries and Grok Radio. And the views expressed in this program and by our guests may not necessarily reflect those of CYI Worldwide Ministries or its staff. And now, enjoy the show.
You stand on the shore of the ocean watching the tide come in. You sense the call of the sea beckoning to take you in further. You step forward little by little, not knowing what to expect, but expecting more. You keep going as the ocean calls you to enter in to deeper waters.
Hello, everyone. I'm Nick Peters. This is the Deeper Waters podcast. I was scheduled to have Hogwarts Professor show up on here to talk about the relationship that he's found between Harry Potter and Christianity. So far, he hasn't shown up yet. If he shows up later, well, that's fine. If not, well, I guess I'll just have to talk about something else. So understand that anything that's being done on this show today, it's kind of being done on the fly, but that's what you have to prepare yourself for when you're in this kind of world. And I always tell people in the projects industry that you have to be ready to speak on a moment's notice. You never know when you will be ready to be called upon in order to give an answer for what you believe, for what's going on in your world, and that's what Christianity is doing in the life of you and the people around you. So, today, I think I will just talk about those kinds of matters, and if our guest shows up later on, he shows up, I can stop talking, believe it or not, it is possible, okay? I'm sure Ali over there is listening somewhere here, being, I'm not very sure if it is possible for my husband to be quiet, but yeah, it really is possible. So, let's talk about some things that I've been seeing going on this week that I generally find concerning, okay? Now, first off, if you live in Tennessee, something you see making the news is a story about this preacher in the Lafayette area. Now, I know this well since I live in Tennessee, of course, who's been caught handling snakes in his services. And the Tennessee Wildlife Resources Agency, TWRA, has come and taken the snakes. I think there were 53 of them, and they said that some of them weren't in the best condition, and they were brought to the Knoxville Zoo. Now, as it happens, last Saturday and Sunday was a free zoo weekend over there, and so what I did was take my wife there, since she loves the zoo, and while I was there, I went and talked some people in the herpetology office, which is study of snakes, and ask them some questions, and pretty much got everything that I need confirmed. These are venomous snakes, and they are dangerous. Now, the Knoxville Zoo didn't think that this would lead to death normally. They said it could lead to the damaging of blood cells and of nerve cells, and that would result quite possibly in amputation. Yeah, I'm sure, well, most of us really don't really care for the idea of dying. We probably also don't care for having amputations take place. I don't know about you, but I tend to use my arms and legs. I enjoy having them around, and I want to keep them. Now, I also went a step further. I emailed the TWRA as well, just ask questions. Now, they couldn't answer questions about this specific court hearing, because this pastor is going to face trial here, what he's done with holding these snakes illegally. They couldn't comment on that. I understand that. I respect that. But they could tell me about the nature of these snakes. And it's fair contention that these snakes could result in death for people who don't have good immune systems at the time, such as children who haven't had their immune systems developed, or be elderly, you could have an immune system starting to shut down to some extent. If any of these get bit, it could very well result in death. Now, these snakes, they're what's called Class 1 creatures. And Class 1 creatures are creatures that pose a real threat to human beings and need proper care in order to be handled. See, my wife has an interest in foxes. She wouldn't mind owning a fox someday. Fox is a class 3 animal. It's not necessarily a threat after all, though we could say maybe a fox could carry some parasites and such. I'm not too sure about that. But you do have to have proper licensing and care in order to be able to raise a fox. You have to be trained. You have to get certified by the state to have a fox. That's just for a class 3. And when you get to class 2, it's even stronger. When you get to class 1, it's the strongest of all. Now, as I said, these snakes were found to not be in good condition. And who could be surprised with that? There were 53 of them. You know how difficult it would be to have to take care of 53 snakes? It would be extremely difficult. And this guy was claiming to take care of these snakes. Now, he's pleaded not guilty to possessing the snakes, which to me seems a nonsensical position. He's got a TV show on National Geographic that has him holding these snakes. How on earth can this be denied? Okay, so, and now this I consider problematic enough. Here's what really concerns me the most in all of this. It's what I see the church doing in response. So I've been watching this story because it's a local story. And actually this guy was on a radio show a while back, within the past year and a half, since I know I lived here at the time. And I did get to talk to him, and I found he wasn't really equipped to answer the hard objections to his position. And we're talking to someone who's a King James Onlyist, which shouldn't be too much of a surprise. And this passage comes this teaching largely comes from a passage in Mark 16:18. Now, if you know your biblical scholarship very well, you know that Mark 16:9-20 is one of the most disputed passages in the New Testament. There are very few passages that we can definitely say, yeah, this was added on later by another scribe. But the long ending of Mark is one of them. Keep in mind, this is just one of the extra endings of Mark. There are others. This passage would be held in dispute. I, for one, don't see it as authentic. I don't think Mark wrote this passage. That's not a liberal position, because I'm sure several Christians are having, where you've taken a liberal stance. No, I've taken a stance in accordance with the evidence that I see. The evidence is this doesn't show up until later in manuscripts, and there are several non-Markan words, and it just doesn't fit with the whole overall narrative. I think Mark wanted his ending the way he had it intentionally. I think he wanted awe and surprise and shock. And yes, he has the resurrection in him there, because Jesus talks about it in Mark 14 when he's being arrested in the garden. So it's not that Mark was denying the resurrection, or that later Gospel said, well, Mark left this open-ended, we're going to put the resurrection in here. And besides, we have a resurrection in the early Pauline epistles, so that wouldn't be a problem anyway. What I'm saying right now is, this passage, I don't really think is authentic. And I doubt this pastor could really address the objections against it. Now, what I see the church doing, what you're hearing is, the church is flocking after this guy and saying, this is an issue of religious persecution. This is separation of church and state that needs to be recognized. And so many people are saying, well, you know, if God moves him to do this, well, who are we to say anything? Now, because I wrote a blog on this with a title of When God Does Not Justify Someone, And the point is, you can't do something that's wrong and point to God and say, I'm doing this because of God, therefore, it's okay. It's not okay. You know, I've been asked before, well, what's going to happen if the state comes after something you hold to be precious? We have a difference with this case is the state does have a moral reason for having this law here. This law is not in place to persecute Christians. This law is in place to protect people regardless. It's to protect Christians, it's to protect atheists, it's to protect Muslims, it's to protect anyone, because these snakes are dangerous creatures. The reason you can't have one of these snakes is the exact same reason you can't own a pet lion. They're dangerous. And people who are trying to see a one-to-one parallel, I think that's often happening in these situations, are going to just get themselves in trouble. Now, what happens if a state decides it's going to outlaw Bibles and such? Well, in that case, yeah, we do have to do something, because there isn't a moral basis for that one. If someone thinks Christianity is a threat to the state, then you know what we do? We present evidence that shows no, Christianity is not a threat to the state. And if we point it, someone says, well, what about the homosexual objection? You keep saying that you think that homosexuals shouldn't be able to force Christian photographers to take pictures of their ceremonies and such. Yeah, I do. That's a conscience clause. The homosexual community can go anywhere else and get a photographer. What it is they're trying to force a moral view on people to say, you cannot say X is immoral. When we have evidence and reason to think, yes, X is immoral. We have plenty of evidence in this case to show these snakes are dangerous creatures. Now, what I see being said also is that no one at one of these snake handling churches is forced. Hold on, we got someone called. Yes, Faye left. It says, no one is forced to pick up one of these snakes. Well, I agree. They're not. But what happens if a snake bites someone, and then after a while, it gets itself loose, and it's on the move? Is it likely to go after a child? Is it likely to go after an adult? What if that happens? What if one of these gets loose because they're not being careful, probably? Maybe you'll see a mouse running across the church or something and go chasing after it. What if that happens? Accidents happen with animals constantly. Even with professionals, accidents happen. Accidents have happened at zoos. Accidents have happened at circuses. These things go wrong. And when it happens, innocent victims who weren't doing anything are indeed just fat. Victims. Now, what about the people who are saying, well, God's moving him to do this? The problem is, so many of us, we don't have a valid method of determining where it is that we think God is moving us to do. Just this past Thursday, my wife and I were at the farmer's market. And who do we see there but some Mormons? And let's talking with them. Doesn't become an apologetics talk, it just becomes a social talk. You know, these Mormons, they'll tell you that God's moved in them. He's given them the burning in the bosom. And by that, they know Mormonism is true. Now, anyone out there who's thinking that God's doing the work of telling people to pick up serpents, I seriously doubt you're also thinking God's telling people that Mormonism is true. Unfortunately, I will confess, I do have some concerns that some of you might be thinking, well, yeah, they're just Christians like we are, which is something Joel Osteen said, that Mitt Romney was just as Christian as he was, which I thought, well, There was something I can agree with Joel Osteen on, at least. It's, I mean, hey, I'm a conservative, I supported Romney, I voted for him. But I don't see him as a Christian. He's a Mormon. There's a difference. And, of course, we have people like, say, Andrea Yates, who drowned her children because she really believed God was wanting her to do that. So how do you know which is which? No, hold on. It looks like we've got John Granger is here, and he's about to call in, so see if I can reach him here. Hold on, folks. He's calling on. Give me just a second here. Let me apologize for the delay, folks. I don't know what went wrong. If anyone wants to read more of my thoughts on this matter, then we can. You can just go to my blog now. Looks like John's trying to call in. We're working this out, and I am going to be giving him a call here. Okay.
John.
Hey. Yeah. I understand there was a time zone misunderstanding here. That's okay.
All right. I'm sorry I'm so late.
It's all right. Better late than never.
Okay.
Okay.
Are you
all
Nick?
Right. Yep. And this, you're on the air right now. So.
Oh, hello.
Yep. So, Dr. Granger, I'm guessing you do. It is Dr. Granger, right?
It's just John. I'm not a doctor or anything like that.
Okay, I saw you were a professor. I couldn't find anything for sure, but it's a couple minutes until our first break, so before we get to the break, how about telling the audience a little bit about yourself? They might not know who you are, so just tell us a little bit about your story in a couple minutes.
All right. My name is John Granger. Sometimes called the Hogwarts Professor. That's what my website is called, hogwartsprofessor.com. I'm the author of 7 books,
mm-hmm.
6 of which are about the Harry Potter series. My my core thesis about the Harry Potter books is that they're as popular as they are because they're suffused with Christian content. Specifically, the traditional artistry and meaning of the books has such a resonance with the human heart that people respond to it with the enthusiasm that they do. This is sometimes called the Iliadi thesis because Mercy Iliadi said in The Sacred and the Profane that in a secular culture, reading serves a mythic or a religious function. Well, what that means is essentially is that in a culture that doesn't believe in God, we find ways to transcend ourselves any way we can. Some people do it with sex, some people do it with sports, big sporting events, giant stadiums full of people. But a lot of people do it with story, especially with movies and with books, where they get out, they suspend their disbelief, they enter into a story with their imagination, and they get outside of their ego self in that experience. Now, my corollary to Iliadi's thesis that I've argued in various books is that if this is true, that reading serves this mythic function, then the books that are the most popular are the ones that will serve this function most readily. In effect, the ones that have the most Christian symbolism, have the most spiritual content, the ones that make that elision between subject and object, the reader and the story, the easiest. And so we see books like The Lord of the Rings and The Chronicles of Narnia, Harry Potter, looks like The Hunger Games, And they have a boatload of Christian content in them, which is always well, just below the surface, so that the reader enters into the story without feeling they're being preached at, and yet has this experience of something much greater than themselves. I mean, who I am, that's basically what I do, is I argue that thesis against the idea that these books are just popular because they're marketed well, or they're... Or they're a well-told adventure story. Believe me, if it were a marketing thing, Nick, every book would be marketed like Harry Potter, and every book would sell 500 million copies. I mean, if it's just a matter of getting a good buzz on the ground, then every marketer in the country would have that as his goal. You have to have a product first, and the product that works, as you see even in books like Twilight, which use a lot of the same artistry that Harry Potter does, that even those books have that, generate that response inside the readers who are longing for this means to transcend their relatively mundane existence.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you wanted? I mean, I'm an Orthodox Christian. I'm a graduate of the University of Chicago. I'm a reader in the Orthodox Church. I've got 7 children who homeschool. But that's not really. I go right into the Iliad thesis because that's probably what most people want to know. Maybe what they want to know is how to get involved with this. I'm really something of a snob, Nick.
Let's put that on hold. I'm going to take a quick break, and when we get back, I'll ask you about that. Okay.
Great.
Okay, I'm Nick Peters. This is the Deeper Waters podcast. We'll be back after this break.
Join Unituber and Army Girl for Christ as they discuss spiritual warfare, spiritual preparedness, the end times, life issues, and personal and spiritual growth. That's www.truthradionet.com. Truthradionet.com.
I can't believe the news.
I'm Nick Peters. This is the Deeper Waters podcast. I'm here, and my guest today is John Granger, Hogwarts professor, talking about Harry Potter and Christianity. A very interesting topic today. Now, you were starting to tell us about how you got into this kind of thing, and I know how you got into it from the book, but obviously it's just because you've been a great fan of fantasy literature, and you just ran out and got these books immediately when they came out and couldn't wait to get into them. That's the story, isn't it?
No, it's not. You know, it's not. I'm a snob, and my wife's probably worse than a snob than I am. My objection was I was working in a store in Houston, and the person in charge of the benefits and generating the paychecks for everybody, she told me about this great book called Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. And I said, I'm an Orthodox Christian. Sorcery is not really what we do. It's not something we do, playfully. It's something that involves invocation of spirits and stuff, and it's not a good thing. I mean, and so I can't believe this book is any good if it starts off with Harry Potter and with a sorcerer's stone. And she says, "Oh, John, let me explain it to you." So she explains to you, this guy goes to a school and he's going to be a wizard. And I said, "Well, we're not getting any better here if it's invocational magic." And she just keeps saying, so I go home to my wife and I say, "Hey, Stephanie, with her orange hair and her tattoo on her neck and, stud in her tongue, whatever, she does not like, her name was Tiffany, not Stephanie. And she says, I said, Tiffany really loves these books. And my wife says, "Well, if Tiffany likes them, I'm pretty sure that we can safely avoid them." And then she said, "It's Harry Potter." And I said, "Yeah." I said, "What are they?" And she said, "Well, you must be living on the moon because every bookstore you go into has a giant, giant display of Harry Potter books. And I avoid them," she said, "because anything that popular couldn't be any good." And, well, I thought, okay, so that's 2 strikes against Harry Potter. I said, "Let's not let Harry Potter into our house." Well, my kids are, my oldest daughter was 11, and my next youngest daughter was 9, And they were kind of saying, hey, our friends were talking about Harry Potter. And I said, well, we don't do Harry Potter. Harry Potter's, you know, a craze or whatever, but it's not a good thing. Now, I don't have a television in my house. I don't listen to the radio. I don't read newspapers. So I was totally unaware. I was living in Houston, Texas. I mean, they were having barbecues that all the barbecues were being lit by Harry Potter books. I mean, the Baptists were furious with Harry Potter. So,
yeah.
And I was totally clueless this was happening. All I knew was that Tiffany liked them, and I was telling her she liked them for the wrong reason. Well, our pediatrician, this wonderful Baptist woman with three children, homeschooled, the whole thing, she gives the first Harry Potter paperback, Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, to my oldest daughter, unbeknownst to me. So I come home one day from work, and my daughter is walking around the house backwards, away from me, with her hands behind her back. And I'm like, Hannah, what are you doing? And she says, I'm going to go to the bathroom. I said, well, usually if you go to the bathroom, you walk forward rather than backwards. If you fall down, you might have, you know, some leakage. What are you walking backwards for? And she kind of drops her head, and she pulls out the book she's hiding behind her back, which is, of course, Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. And I said, oh, Harry Potter has breached the barriers of my household. I said, well, here's the deal. I take the book from her, and I say, I'm going to read this book tonight. And tomorrow, I'm going to explain to you why we don't read trash like this. And she, you know, she's like, oh, great, you know. Not only do I not get to read the book, but I have to listen to a lecture. You know, this is going to be terrible.
Mm-hmm.
So I put all the kids to bed later that day. And I sit down with the book. It's pretty late. I have to get up early. And I'm thinking, this can't take me 10 minutes. You know, there's going to be some invocational magic. He's going to, you know, call in some demon or spirit or whatever, some genie or whatever to help him out. And I'm going to be able to say, oh, we don't do that. There it is. Ta-da, sorcery. See? Silly, stupid. Now, I'll explain the whole thing between, you know, what kind of magic is, you know, good in literature, what kind of magic is bad in literature. I got my speech already drafted, and I start to read the book, and, of course, it's a spectacular opening. Apparently, Rowling spent, you know, she spent 5 years plotting the books, but apparently she rewrote the opening to Sorcerer's Stone 5, 6, 7 times, entirely new versions of that chapter. And it is a wow. It is an absolute hook. I mean, it really has you drawn in, wanting to know more about, you know what happened, about this whole world and who the Dumbledore character is. I mean, it's got everybody. It's got the Dursleys. I mean, this is a wow adventure and a great opening. So I'm hooked, and I read this thing straight through. I mean, certainly it's a Harry Potter book. It's a very short book. And I fly through it. It's 17 chapters. I'm banging them through it. You know, it's 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. I'm just like, whoa, this is great. You know, this is like the Chronicles of Narnia. This is great. You know, and I'm thinking, I got about 3 or 4 chapters in, and I realized, oh, it's not a Sorcerer's Stone. It's a Philosopher's Stone. Because I studied alchemy when I was in college.
Yep.
I mean, at least literary alchemy. So I'm saying, oh, my goodness. Why do they call it Sorcerer's Stone? What am I, an idiot? You know, I know nothing about the whole story, about how they changed the title. I'm just thinking, oh, this is great stuff. I love it. So the next morning, you know, I get up and I'm ready to jump on my bike and go to work. And my daughter gets up with her little, you know, fluffy slippers or whatever. And she comes out and I say, hey, I've got some good news and I've got some bad news. And she's doing the, oh, you know, and she's looking at me like, I got the lecture. It's going to be a cute lecture. You know, it's going to be a stupid lecture. And I said, here's the good news. The good news is you can read the book. And I give her the paperback. She looks through it like I've torn pages out. You know, she's going through the book. You know, how could he possibly give me the book back? He must have torn the things he didn't like out of it. I've never done that, but she was really suspicious. I gave her the book. And I said, the bad news is you have to read the book. It's that good. I mean, you're required to read the book. I'm going to start reading it aloud to the younger children tonight, and I'm going to buy the other books in the series that are available. The second and third books were already out at that point. So I went to work, and there was a bookstore next to where I worked, so I picked up the second and third copies. And I apologized to Tiffany, who it turns out is a Unitarian. I thought she was some sort of, you know, quasi-Hindu or whatever. Anyway, she and I apologized. You know, I judged I judged that book by your cover, you know, and you were right. You were right. You knew I would love it, and you were right. I loved it. And then I got it. Then I had friends at work saying to me, John, you're kind of our token Christian here on the staff. Like, it was not a Christian organization. And I said, well, what am I doing wrong? How am I failing in my faith here as a witness to you guys? And they said, you're reading Harry Potter. Don't you know that everybody hates Harry Potter who's a Christian? And I said, whoa, what are you talking about? Because, again, I didn't know that First Baptist in Houston had started, you know, a whole, you know, their picketing thing. I thought, what is going on? I said, what are you talking about? And so a friend sent me a URL that said it had stories about people hating Harry Potter. And I said, wow, is this crazy? Because, I mean, the Philosopher's Stone, what this is actually a symbol of Christ. I mean, in the title, it's as if they said Harry Potter and the Unicorn, that would be a problem for Christians. And so I would start to explain to people, well, here's really the Christian story. Well, Tiffany was fascinated, and that was probably my first audience for this kind of conversation. And then I went to the we moved, I read the books myself. I read the first three books, and then the fourth book came out. I read them out loud to my children. So that's the second time I read them. And then we traveled from Houston to the Olympic Peninsula of Washington State. And on that move, we listened to the tapes of Harry Potter and all in the first four books. Well, so I've read the books this time three or four times, listened to them, and I get to Fort Townsend, Washington, which is really the upper left-hand corner. It's a little east of Forks, but it's pretty close to the edge there. And I get invited to a C.S. Lewis Society meeting in town. Well, I'm new to town. I don't know anybody. I think, hey, this is a great place to meet Christians, and Christians like to read books. And so I go to the C.S. Lewis Society meeting. And two guys who wound up being very good, dear friends of mine were talking about Harry Potter. And they were saying what trash it was and why aren't these kids reading, you know, Narnia or Lord of the Rings or something really good. And I said, you guys are kidding, right? Have you read these books? And they said, no. Now, who needs to read trash like that? And I said, oh, God, whoa. Now, remember, I'm brand new in town. I have no idea who I am. And I say, these books are really just like the Chronicles of Narnia in many respects. And in some ways, they're better. And they look at me like, who is this moron that's just moved into town? So they say, look, John, we can see you're really excited about this. So why don't you give a talk to us next month at our meeting about how good Harry Potter is? And I said, well, sure. So I had a flip chart at home, you know, one of these easel flip chart things I use for the kids homeschooling or whatever. And so I made a flip chart called Taking Harry Seriously. Well, I get to the thing, and it was a fire hose lecture. It was 90 minutes of me talking about all of the Christian symbolism, all of the alchemy, everything I could find in the first four books. And because these guys were fluent in the language of the Inklings, I could say a lot in shorthand that I would normally have to explain to other people. Well, they are overwhelmed. It was a crazy talk. I'd never be able to give it again. It was the first time I'd ever given a talk about Harry Potter. And the local librarian, the big Carnegie Library in Port Townsend, she says to me, John, you've got to give this talk at the library because there's only like 12 of us here. The whole town's going to want to hear about this. You give this talk at the library, and I'll make sure we tell everybody to come see it and whatever. And I say, hey, great. It's tough to give a lecture that you like and then realize you probably never give it again, right? So here she says, go ahead, give it a second performance. It's a second act. Well, I go to the library with my flip chart, and I decided that was too much, especially if it's going to be younger people there. So I broke it into three talks called Taking Harry Seriously. And what surprised me about that talk was that there was a film crew there. It turns out that every public event at the library is filmed by the local cable station. At least it was 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So I stand there, and I give my talk. And the the cable guy film it. Nice guy. And I said, can I have a copy of that tape you're done? He says, oh, yeah, sure, come by the studio, and I'll throw you a tape. Well, it turns out, I mean, and people in Port Townsend probably saw if they had cable. I don't know. I didn't have, you know, I don't watch television, so I had no idea what that was about. Well, sure enough, not only did it play on the Olympic Peninsula, but the cable guy thought it was a good show, so he traded the tapes with friends in Seattle and in Portland. And all of a sudden, this tape is being shown on cable stations up and down the Northwest Coast. Well, the word gets out. Hey, because at that point, the story was Christian Tate, Harry Potter, Harry Potter's The Gateway to the Occult, the author's a witch, you know, all this crazy stuff. Well,
And I also am pretty sure now it was being spread there. It was probably being spread on YouTube at the same time.
Oh, yeah, this was everywhere. So all of a sudden, there's this one voice in the upper left-hand corner of the country saying, oh, no, the reason the books are so popular is because there's so much Christian content in them. Well, this is like man bites dog. So people begin to get curious about this. Now, here's where this story gets really weird and happily providential. The head of the C.S. Lewis Society was married to a woman that designed books. I mean, he was wonderfully wealthy, so she didn't need to do it. She just did it because that's what she liked doing. She was very good at it. Well, she was also sick, and she was recovering from a really serious illness. He wanted her to have a project to work on, a book to work on, so that she could take her mind off the whole healing process. You know, give her something to be doing rather than just sitting around thinking about being better. He said, John, I want you to write up those three lectures and just type them up. Just type them up. And my wife will turn them into a beautiful book. We'll print up, you know, 400 or 500 copies. We'll sell them on Amazon. You'll have a book for your resume, and she'll have this project. He said, what do you think? I said, well, fine. You know, what the heck? So in the evenings, I would spend an hour or two just typing. And in 6 weeks, I typed up all my lecture notes. I send the Word files to Steve. Steve gives them to his wife, and almost instantly, it seemed to me, he turned them into a beautiful book called Hidden Key to Harry Potter.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I thought that was pretty much the end of the story. She had some connections in publishing. He had some connections in book distribution. He said he was confident that he'd be able to get the book on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. Great. He says I'm gonna order the book. This was before POD, print-on-demand was really a going thing. So he's going to order copies from a big publisher, you know, an actual publisher, like a person who publishes books, you know, prints the books, big printer in Minnesota, and have them sent out the peninsula. He says, John, a big truck's going to arrive in your front yard, and you can put these things in your attic, and we'll send them to Amazon as the orders come in, whatever. I thought, oh, that's great. What a happy ending to this story, right? I got a book for my thing. Well, the truck arrives, and the truck is, you know, a giant semi-truck, you know, 16-wheeler, which is not that uncommon on the peninsula because everything that gets out there, obviously, either arrives by ship, which is not very often, or comes by truck up around the peninsula, up around the sound. So they don't like to send, you know, trucks all the way out there unless they're full, and they want to be big trucks, et cetera. So here comes this giant truck, and I think, okay, it's going to be this. We're going to be the very end of this truck because they'll have stuff for the grocery store and the furniture store and all these things. Well, the guy opens up the truck, and he starts pulling pallets of boxes off. And eventually he gets 5 pallets of boxes off, and each one of these pallets is taller than I am. Now, I'm not a very tall guy, Nick. I'm like 5'4". But still, I'm looking at these pallets thinking, wow, if this is 500 books, there must be like one book per box. You know, I mean, how many books did he order? Well, it turns out he said that, you know, you get a quantity discount, and it was, he says, it's not even worth getting just 500, so I ordered 5,000. And I'm thinking, oh, no. I'm going to die. They're going to have a bonfire of all these books that never sold. Or they're going to be in my attic, and they're going to collapse and kill one of my children in the bedroom. You know, it's going to be such a huge weight in my attic. So we had a party. I had friends come over. They did pictures of us all standing around these giant pallets. and all my kids and their friends carried these boxes up three flights of stairs to the attic. And I think that's pretty much the end of the story. Well, yes and no. Because
John?
John? Yep.
Can we pause the story right there? We got to take another break.
All right.
Okay. We're going to take another break. We'll be right back. I'm Nick Peters of Deeper Waters Podcast. Guest is Hogwarts Professor John Granger. We'll be back after this break.
It's here, the official Grok Radio mobile app. Listen to your favorite Grok Radio programs on your iPhone, iPad, iPod, Kindle Fire, Android smartphone, and tablet. The best thing is, it's absolutely free. Download it now from the iTunes or Google Play App Store, or get a link at our website, cyiworldwide.com. Grok Radio, Christian radio that doesn't suck.
Okay, and we're back here now. John Granger is my guest. He's talking to us about being a Hogwarts professor and how they're talking about, you've had this semi come to your house. It's got, I think, 5,000 books, he says. You got all these, which to me, that's light reading, okay? But you've got all these books here, and, you know, but kind of that Hermione would probably go through in a week or so. So, what happened?
There are 5,000 copies of one book, and nobody's expressed any interest in buying them. And, well, then what happens, two things happen. One, a man named Steve Vander Ark at a website called Harry Potter Lexicon, he was working at a Christian school, and he was very involved with Harry Potter, and his headmaster or his principal wasn't excited about him being involved with Harry Potter. So I sent him a copy of my book, and he loved it and gave it to the principal of the school, and the principal said, hey, this is a good argument. You know, this is an argument about how worthy the books are for Christian attention. Well, Steve posted a thing on his website, which at that point was the biggest website in Harry Potter fandom, still one of the top two or three. And so a lot of people that came to the website said, oh, look, a book that talks about how good Harry Potter is instead of how bad it is. Then there was a conference in Orlando, Florida at Disney World called Nimbus 2003. It was in the summer of 2003. And it was right after the fifth book came out. Well, they flew me down there because of a woman named Penny Linsenmeyer, a lawyer in Houston, loved my book, and argued with them and convinced them to fly me down there to do this. And they had 70 talks and panels at that conference, and my talk on literary alchemy and Harry Potter was voted the best talk of the whole thing. I brought two or three boxes of books, so I had to carry them all down there. They all sold out immediately. And those people who read it and who bought it, they told their friends, and all of a sudden the book started to take off. Well, then all those thousands of books I had in my attic, every single day, Nick, I had to grab two or three boxes, address them to the Amazon distribution center, and send them out. Because they didn't have POD, and I had the copies of the books. So they would call me and say, okay, we've sold another 40 copies, send us this and that. And so every day I'm mailing these, doing my full-time job, which is carrying boxes. The post office thinks I'm dealing drugs or something because I'm every day coming with these really heavy bricks of things. That's how I became the Hogwarts professor. I went from being, a Latin teacher on the upper left-hand corner of the country to being, one of the world experts on Harry Potter. I've given talks at Yale and Princeton and Chicago and Pepperdine. St. Andrews in Scotland had a big conference on that, and I keynoted that talk. So Harry Potter's taken me all over the world, which has been and you talk at all these great universities. It has been a wonderful, wonderful treat. But it's, again, people say to me, John, how do I become a writer? How do I get published? And I say, well, I'm the last person you can ask because it all just happened to me. Happened despite my intentions. I was upset when I got 5,000 copies. Then the fact that the 5,000 copies sold out meant that Tyndale wanted to publish it. So it became Looking for God and Harry Potter, and it sold 60,000 copies now. So it's been.
Yeah, and I do have a copy of that book. I've read it. It's excellent. And I was laughing sometimes during your talk because I know how the story turns out. That makes it absolutely hysterical. And I'm sure that had you been told some years ago when this whole thing started that someday you'd be Hogwarts professor, you would have thought, if you really think that, you're crazy.
Well, it's pretty close to that, Nick. What's funny is, of course, my last name is Granger, and so
yep.
the smart character in the books is named Granger as well. So I'm constantly asked, did you change your name? I've gone totally around the twist, and so now you've identified with this and you've become that. So yeah, it seems almost as if I was born for this role, though, because one of the things that's odd is people say, how can you see these things that nobody else sees until you point them out? And the answer, isn't any kind of brilliance. My critics will definitely tell you that. It's not brilliance. What it is that my background, my education, my upbringing is very much like that of the author. I mean, the author, even though we grew up on other sides of the Atlantic Ocean, she grew up in a family that was that were Episcopalian, what we call Episcopalian, what they call Anglican, and not especially warm in the faith. But what was interesting was that both of us continued to go to church when the parents stopped going. Our form of juvenile rebellion was to go to church and Rowling enjoys Victorian literature, 19th century literature. She enjoys Lewis and Tolkien a lot. She enjoys E. Nesbitt. She enjoys, and she was asked once if she ever wanted to be a witch. She said, no, I never wanted to be a witch, but an alchemist, that's a different matter. She said, I read a boatload of books on alchemy before I wrote Harry Potter, and it sets the whole magical parameters of the series. Well, I spent a good deal of time after college reading books by Titus Burkhardt, one of which is just called Alchemy. And that book gave me a whole, idea of how to see the world traditionally. And it also opened up a lot of literature, because a lot of traditional literature, there's a book called Dark Hieroglyphics by Stanton Linden, in which he describes literary alchemy in the English tradition from Chaucer to the Restoration. And it's a trope. I mean, it really goes much farther than that. C.S. Lewis was very much into alchemy. The whole space trilogy is based on it. But that, or scaffolding, is built on the scaffolding, which is alchemical. And that, I knew that. So when I realized that the Sorcerer's Stone in Harry Potter was a Philosopher's Stone, then it was easy to see that she was using alchemy as a base camp. We didn't find out that she said that about alchemy until 2007, even though she made the comments in 1998. The newspaper interview where that was given wasn't posted online for people to find it until, almost 10 years later. So I'd already talked about it at great length. People thought I was insane. It was basically misogyny. People were saying that she couldn't be writing literary alchemy like Shakespeare because she's an unemployed woman in England. That's nuts. Obviously they were wrong. Here's this interview with her from ages ago saying, yeah, that's all about the alchemy. And she started talking about it more now in Pottermore as well. Anyway, the fact that her background and my background are so similar. We're great books wonks. We went to great books university. We were classics majors. We read a lot of Latin and Greek. So that I could translate the spells for my kids. The kids suddenly were interested in Latin because they could translate the spells, and that was a great thing. I've even taught the books to homeschooling groups. I've taught Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, Philosophy Lapis, to one military academy classroom and two homeschooling groups. So I've read the first book in Latin, 2.5-3 times. That common background that we have meant that when I read the book, I picked up a lot of the jokes that are just another level beneath the surface that was able to explain that. That and having read Iliadi made me think that the reason this book is so popular is not because it's evil, which is kind of a leap. You know, why would an evil book become really popular? You know, people embrace what is good more easily than things that are evil. So it's an easier step, actually, even though it was against what people were saying, to suggest that Harry Potter was popular because it was edifying reading rather than the gateway to the occult.
Okay. Well, we obviously can't cover everything today, but just give us a brief, like, you're going through this first book, Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, and you're looking for all the demonic stuff and such, and instead you find quite the opposite. What did you find? What are some tidbits that you found in there that particularly told you, hold on, there's something different here?
Well, I can remember the moment where I really thought, oh, this is brilliant. Rowling was once asked, you know, what she thought of people comparing her to C.S. Lewis. And she said, well, Lewis is a genius, and I am not a genius. And I thought, yeah, that's a good thing for everybody to say. You know, Lewis was a genius, and anybody who's happy with being compared to C.S. Lewis probably is a self-important git. You know, I mean, probably not somebody who's that thoughtful or whatever. So, that was reassuring to hear her say that she wasn't a genius. But the moment that made me think, before I knew any of that, that she was a brilliant writer that was smuggling the gospel was in that scene in the Forbidden Forest where Harry, Draco, Neville, Hermione, and
Hagrid.
Hagrid and what's the name of the dog? Help me out, Fluffy. But they're all out in the woods there, and
it was
looking
a Fang.
For this Fang. Thank you. I should tell you, Nick, that this is a great frustration. People don't meet me. They say, "Gosh, he couldn't remember the name of Hagrid's dog." I mean, how well does he know these books? What I bring to the stories is not a command of the detail. I can never remember. I did the Three Broomsticks and all the shops in Hogsmeade. I can't remember any of those things.
Yeah. If I'm remembering, Fluffy was the name of a Cerberus. So
Fluffy was
a dog's name, just a different dog.
Yeah, well, you can imagine how much that's worth to fans. They're like, John, you're an idiot. Anyway, so, yeah, Fang's out in the story. Fang's out in the forest, and we're looking for this unicorn who's been killed or wounded, at least bleeding horribly in the forest. Hagrid's very concerned about it. It's a horrible thing. It's just a horrible impiety to hunt a unicorn. And we get that literally terrific, terrifying scene in which Harry and Draco come up on the unicorn when this serpent, this human being like a serpent, is drinking the blood of the unicorn. I mean, absolutely horrific scene. And Draco has the appropriate human response, which is to scream out loud and run for the hills. Harry, he just freezes because his scar hurts. And we get, that's probably the first time we get Harry's "my scar hurt worse than ever before" line, which he uses sometimes twice in a book. You know, I always wonder if he's got some sort of scarometer going. Anyway, Harry freezes, and Ferenczi jumps in, saves him from this serpent figure. We find out later is Quirrell the Mort, and Ferenczi, you know, takes him back to Hagrid. But while he's on the way back to Hagrid, you recall, he says, "Harry Potter, do you know what unicorn's blood is used for?" He says, "No, we've only used the tail hairs." And, you know, Harry's not the sharpest knife in the drawer or whatever. Ferenczi says, "Oh, no. He says, "Here's what it's used for. No matter how close you are to death, if you drink unicorn's blood, your life will be saved. But if you drink it unworthily, you'll be damned." Well, you know, Nick, I mean, I almost dropped the book. I mean, literally, this is 1 Corinthians 11, 27-29, right? This is St. Paul on the Eucharist in story form, where he basically says, you know, if you eat this food unworthily, you'll be damned. The reason all of us are, you know, largely asleep in our lives now is that we're communing unworthily. Now, that makes sense in that chapter because the unicorn is a traditional symbol of Christ. And the serpent, you know, you don't have to read very far in the Bible to come across the serpent as the bad guy, right? The serpent's the bad guy, and here is the serpent drinking the blood of Christ to save its life, you know, to keep it alive. But he's damned for that. Really, we know at the end of the story, right there in the forest, that Voldemort can't win. He's St. Paul has told us that in 1 Corinthians. But anyway, I'm reading the book thinking, oh my goodness, we're getting Eucharistic theology in a story form, and it's totally smuggled. It's totally underneath all the eyes of the watchful dragons are asleep. You know, they can't possibly see that this is what it is. Because people in the United States, they think of unicorns as just kind of nice creatures. They don't really see them as symbols of Christ the way they are in all medieval tapestries and medieval iconography. Mm-hmm. So this event, I remember just dropping the book thinking, oh, that is so cool. that is so wonderful. I can't wait to tell my kids, you know, what that is. And after they've enjoyed the story, I can say, hey, do you know why that's a real wow, you know? And that's because they'd read the Chronicles of Narnia, they'd heard me tell the stories, and they knew the gospel parallels inside those things. So it was reading that moment, thinking, oh my gosh, is that brilliant or what? And then when I read the books out loud to my children, we get to the point at the end of the book where Quirrell de Mort is wrestling with Harry on the ground, and he grabs Harry's skin, and he pulls back his hand, screaming, because by touching his skin, his hand has horrific burns on his hand. That Harry's skin somehow is red hot to him and scorches him. Well, and then Dumbledore explains at the end that this is because of the love of his mother. And I turned to my children and said, do you know why the love of Harry's mother would burn someone as evil as Quirrell de Mort? And my oldest daughter, Hannah, said, the same reason the glory of God burns sinners in hell. And that was one of those, you got it, you know, that basically, you know, the love of God is our destiny. You know, we're all going to die. This is our guarantee. We're all going to die, and we're all going to go to the same place. The same place is the glory of God. Now, it's not really a place. It's a non-local place. You know, it's not time and space. But this non-local place that is God's glory will be experienced by those who are prepared for it as the greatest delight they've ever had. Mm-hmm. And those people who are not prepared for it will experience that exact same non-local place as the same, like if you wake up in the morning and the sun is up and it's a beautiful day and the light streaming through your window, you think, oh, what a great day. But if you've been inside a cave your whole life and you see sunlight, your eyes will burn. You'll be in agony from the light. You'll have to squint. You'll be like Gollum or something. Well, that's what the Orthodox fathers teach about what happens to us when we die. So when I read the end of that story, my children, at least my oldest daughter, said, the reason the Quirrell de Mort burns is because the love that's in Harry Potter burns him the way that love is the greatest thing that we could experience. And I thought, this is a great book. You know? I mean, what other kind of book is going to give you that kind of confirmation of things that you want your children to take away from that? There's a cute story, too. I about something much simpler than that, not Christian doctrine so much, as just loving behavior. I mean, I was having a disagreement with a business partner, again in Washington. I had like deliver papers to his office. You know, it's like a legal thing. And I guess what, Nick? I'm good at organizing books and things like that and putting together ideas. I'm not so great at confrontational, you know, relationships. Mm-hmm. So I was just dreading this whole event, having to go into the office and put this on a desk and say, this is what it is, and here's what you have to do, and I'm sorry if you don't like it, but here's your obligations, whatever. And I'm just dreading it. I'm taking my daughter, Sophia,
mm-hmm.
who's now a nun in Greece, believe it or not. Anyway, now Sister Pelagia. Well, she was just a little girl then, and she had a rollerblades on her in this giant van, because I obviously had a big van for my 7 kids. She's sitting in the front seat with her rollerblades kind of dangling off the edge of the front seat, and she's got her violin. She's going to her violin lesson. And I said, look, Sophia, what I'm going to do is I'm going to go into this office. I'm going to drop off this paper, and you can rollerblade around the parking lot if you want, and I should be out in 15 or 20 minutes, God willing. And she says, Dad, what's wrong? And I said, well, I'm just really not looking forward to this because I don't know how this man is going to react, and I have to do this because I have to hold him to his obligations, and he's not going to like this. And she said, trusting God, Dad, and she says what, 7-year-olds, 8-year-olds say, I said, okay, let's do that. I put a good face on it, but I'm still just dreading this. So we get to the van's office, and she hops out of the car, leaves her violins in the car, in the van, and shuts the door right around. And I walk over to the door, and she zooms up right next to me, at the door. And I said, what are you doing, Sophia? And she says, Dad, it's just like Harry Potter. Friends don't let friends face enemies by themselves.
Mm.
And I thought, oh, wow, So she came into the office with me, I thought, okay. And it all worked out. The guy was, But I just thought, wow, what a great thing was it. She thought that I was going to, be facing Fluffy, and she wanted to be there to, be by my side when we face this horrible enemy together, because that's what friends do.
Okay, well, we're going to take a quick break again at this point, the third break of the show, so I've got some more questions when we get back, okay?
Great, look forward to it.
Okay, we'll be back after this break. I'm Nick Peters with Deeper Waters Podcast.
Check out CYIWorldwide.com. CYIWorldwide.com, home of Grok Radio. Free music downloads, advice, prayer, and support. CYIWorldwide.com. Do you grok? Join Army Girl for Christ and Minister Grok as they tackle some of today's pressing issues from a Christian point of view on Truth Be Told, every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. For more information, check out CYIWorldwide.com.
And I'm Nick Peters. This is the Deeper Waters Podcast. If you want to ask a question, our call number is 714-242-5180. We've got John Granger this week, and let you all know what's coming up next week. My ministry partner, J.P. Holding of Tectonics, will be on here. And we'll be talking about his book, Hitler's Christianity, dealing with the claim that Hitler was a Christian. And he's done a lot of research on this to show that, well, no, not really. Well, for now, we've got John Granger, Hogwarts professor, here with us. Now, let's talk about an objection that's raised, and one of your first concerns is that most Christians are looking at saying, there's magic in here. That closes the door right there. So what do you say to the charge of magic?
Well, I mean, they're certainly right. There's a lot of magic in these books. I'd say two or three things. One, if you don't like magic at all in your literature, you're left with a pretty barren world in terms of some of the most Christian works are include a great deal of magic. We've been talking about the Chronicles of Narnia. C.S. Lewis was confronted with this in the 50s. People writing him saying, I can't believe you've got these wizards in the story that are sympathetic figures. Haven't you read the Old Testament? Lewis wrote back, and I think it's something he included in God in the Dock, but he said, look, we've been under a spell. He said, remember your fairy tales, that most good magic is a counterspell. What we need right now is a counterspell to the magic that we've been under for the last 50 years, meaning the materialism, the naturalism and stuff that we live within, and that these stories act as that counterspell, okay? Mm-hmm. It's by having this this magical thing. Now, that's not to say that there's that's the second point. That's not to say that all magic in stories is good.
Yeah.
I said, my assumption when I saw Sorcerer's Stone, which I'm sure it was for many, you know, earnest Christians, was that there was sorcery in it. And sorcery is what they call invocational magic. Invocational magic means, quite literally, you know, you break down the Latin word, it means call in or call down. So that if I'm standing, like in Scripture, calling the name of Beelzebub or such. If you call the name of one of these creatures from the psychic realm, then they come into the world. They come into the world of time and space on being named or called. And the reason that every revealed tradition, not just Christianity, but the reason that every Orthodox tradition condemns this practice is because demons, principalities, powers, whatever, these people from the psychic realm which are fallen, and the angels are also in the psychic realm, but these creatures which are fallen that are in the psychic realm, they never obey the strictures that, you know, under which they come into this realm. And it always causes havoc in individualized families, communities, whatever. It's a nightmare experience. Now, so invocational magic, if it's portrayed as a positive thing, is a disaster because it encourages people to think, oh, I'm gonna rub my magic lamp and have a genie come out or whatever, and that's a good thing. Now, if you note, though, there's another type of magic in stories, and this is the magic that's called incantational magic. Now, incantational magic quite literally means to sing along with. What that means is that they're to harmonize with. That means that, and here's the part that's really rather funny about, or ironic at least, about the objections to Harry Potter, because for incantational magic to work, for speech and words, you know, and spells, whatever, to work, it means that the fabric of reality, of existence, has to be word-based, has to be speech-based, right? If the world is just matter and energy, you know, quantities of atomic material and electromagnetic forces, If that's what the world is, then speech doesn't have any effect on it, right?
Mm-hmm.
If I say hello, Amora, to a door or whatever, and the door is just a door, it's not going to open. But if I believe that the world is made of speech and that my saying the right word will somehow harmonize with the creative word, then maybe something will happen, all right? God allowing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's the reason that incantational magic is the magic from Shakespeare to C.S. Lewis and Joanne Rowling is because it requires, is a possible stretch, but it absolutely has to have a Christian worldview, because we believe as Christians that in the beginning was the Word and everything created was created by God's Word, His Logos. Now, that's the foundation of incantational magic. So when I started to read the book, you know, here I'm just trying to find the spot where we get invocational magic rather than incantational magic, I realized that all of the spell work in the book, every single bit of it, is verbal. They have nonverbal things, but they're still word-based or whatever at the end of the books. Mm. And we have not one instance in any of the seven books of invocational magic. Even the bad guys use incantational magic. The same way that, and people say, well, if it's so good, how can the bad guys do it? Well, the same way that human beings who are designed for love can be hateful and mean. You know, I mean, they may be designed for love, but they can do all of these things. They're still images of God, as bad as we can get, and we can get pretty bad, right? I mean, we are still images of God, and so the wizards can use this speech even though they've made the wrong choices. So when people say to me, "Oh, this is magic, therefore it's bad," I say, "Well, you're going to have a pretty barren world of reading if you do that, because you're throwing out not only the books that show that invocational magic is bad, which is things like Dr. Faustus and stuff, you know, where they make deals with the devil and the devil always wins, And you're throwing out all the incantational magic stories. Now, there's a wonderful illustration of this in the Chronicles of Narnia. I think it's in Prince Caspian, when they're in Aslan's howl, where Prince Caspian and company are trying to figure out what to do while they've blown Susan's horn. Nothing seems to have happened, and Micah Brick and a few others are saying, "Hey, time to go to Plan B." And Plan B, as far as they're concerned, is the White Witch. It's to call in a hag who's going to call down the spirit of the White Witch and bring her into the world again to serve their purposes. Now, you can imagine how that would have worked out, right? I mean, we know that's a bad idea, but they don't even let the hag get to work. I mean, they have a big fight, and the lights go out, and they end up killing her, this, that, and the other. Because just the very idea of it is anathema. The idea of invocational magic is so contrary to everything that Aslan would want. He wants the harmonizing song of Susan's horn and for us in faith to trust in him. And sure enough, all the children, the Peventry children arrive, the kings and queens of Narnia arrive, and they win the day in the end. But that requires, again, this harmonizing magic and this faith in God rather than this invocational magic, which is about our selfish, ideas of what we really need and using any means possible to include access to the psychic realm. That's a magnificent story that's just about this conflict. And if you said all magic is bad, you wouldn't be, you'd have to throw that out, right? That's no good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, talk about that. I mean, all of Aslan's stuff, all of Aslan's creating the world, that's Aslan's magic. That's the world which is created. Really, everything that's magic that's incantational magic is about the action of God's word, which is not quantities of matter and energy. I mean, if you believe everything in the world is quantities of matter and energy, then you can't explain existence. You can't explain how God creates everything moment to moment.
Right.
And you don't even think of that as problem. View that's just oxygen. That's the fish. That's the water that the fish are swimming in. They can't even notice the fact that existence is a miracle because it has nothing to do with quantities of matter and energy. It's not about measurable things. So when people attack Harry Potter fans and say, "Oh, you've made your deal with the devil, this, that, and the other," as often as not, they're neglecting the fact that this type of magic and story is based on a Christian worldview and being about the word-based nature of existence, and that it's necessarily edifying because you have to be an image of God in order for that kind of speech to be effective. To be a wizard, originally meant to be a wise man, like a magi, the magi that come to the nativity, that meant that you had to be a person who was aligned or conformed or in some sort of communion with what is most real. So this when people raise, I think to myself sometimes, if this person is saying this because they've been told this by their pastor, well then God bless them. Then they're just saying this in obedience to, what they've been told by people that are in spiritual authority above them. That's fine. My job, Nick, is not to argue with these people. My job is to explain to people who love the stories why they love them so much. My job is not to convince people to read Harry Potter. Why Harry Potter does not need anybody priming the pump, right? Harry Potter is doing fine without John Granger. When I talk to people that don't like Harry Potter, I say, "Well, have you read the books?" And they say, as a rule, to which there have been some exceptions, they say no. And I say, "Well, then we're talking, we're doing something pretty weird here, in that you're condemning something that you have not read, and maybe you've not read it in obedience. I can understand that. I can understand not reading Harry Potter.
Yeah.
But I can't understand attacking people who have read Harry Potter because you think it's wrong and you haven't read it. You can say, I have my misgivings about this, and I've been advised by my spiritual authority not to read that, fine. But until you read it, you should probably keep your mouth shut. It's not much, or to be very sober in your advice, to be very upfront about the fact that you haven't read them, and hear the objections that you heard about them, which made it, easy for you to say no. I mean, it's always easier not to read a book than read a book. Reading a book requires a good deal of effort. I mean, for example, the real thing that broke the what they call the Potter Panic in the evangelistic community was the movies. Because, I mean, Nick, if pastors in these super churches said, don't read Harry Potter, well, that was easy. People, they don't have to buy the book. They don't have to sit down and devote the several hours to sitting and reading. I mean, you can be more righteous by not doing something. That's great. You know, that's a wonderful thing. But when the movie came out, that's very easy to watch a movie. And I think when people who were against Harry Potter, you know, decided to watch the movie and they saw it was pretty harmless, that there's probably more magic in a Star Trek film than there is in Harry Potter, you know, that they just thought, oh, this is crazy. I don't feel like going out and joining a witch's coven. And this is probably the last thing I say to these people is, if Harry Potter was the gateway to the occult, we would see a rise, you know, a stratospheric rise in membership in real-world occult organizations. Okay? The sociologists that track membership roles of occult groups in the United States and in the United Kingdom and in Europe would say, yes, we are seeing jumps in the membership roles. Well, there is an Italian man, Massimo Intravigna, who actually does follow that kind of stuff. And in 2005, he wrote something where he just said, if anything, we're seeing a decline in the membership in these groups. Now, they boast, the only place where you see claims of great rises in the numbers of these groups is from those groups. But when they actually examine those groups, they find that, no, that's not true. It's just like the Communists. The Communist Party in the Soviet Union called themselves the Bolsheviks, which they called themselves the majority. And the bad guys, to them, the white Russians, the Orthodox Christians, they called the Mensheviks, which meant the minority. Well, of course, it was the absolute reverse. I mean, the Mensheviks outnumbered the Bolsheviks 4-1. I mean, there were four Orthodox Christians for every one, you know, socialist communist. But by calling themselves the majority, this is wrong. Well, why would we trust the occult groups we want nobody to join for the membership numbers? What we find, though, from people who study these things, is that we're not seeing a rise. We're actually seeing a decline in numbers for those groups. Nick, you've read the books. You can explain why those numbers have declined. Nobody who has read these books and wants to be like Harry Potter, when they go to a meeting of witches, you know, Wiccans and this and that, they come in there and there's nothing like Harry Potter, nothing. You know, it's a group of usually outlier people that have decided to invent their own religion or whatever, usually a nature religion of some kind, it has nothing to do with words. I mean, the Wiccans themselves have said this. These groups use Harry Potter to troll for members on websites and the internet. I mean, if you Google things like Hogwarts sorting ceremonies, you'll get occult websites that have got Harry Potter sorting ceremonies. See what house you're in, and they'll try to get you to join their coven or whatever at the end of the process. So they use these tools to draw people in. But it doesn't work. Excuse me. I mean, it doesn't work because it's not like the fellowship and the fraternity and the loyalty and the kindness and the sacrificial love that you find inside the books. Maybe that's my last point about the magic controversy, Nick, is that when you get down to it, the magic isn't that big a part of the stories. It almost turns into like the backdrop to the story. These people are all witches and wizards, and they all do certain magic things with their wands, and they've got to have wands. I mean, it's all sorts of requirements and stuff like that. But it's almost as if they all have cell phones. If you told a good adventure story, and everybody had cell phones and they used them, you wouldn't say to somebody, "Hey, this is a book about cell phones, and you need to be really careful if you don't like cell phones, that your kids might really get involved and want cell phones at the end of it." It's not really about the magic. And my kids, they didn't go around the yard using all sorts of spells, playing Harry Potter games and this and that. Well, the one of them that was the most into that the one that was that grew up, I think, because she was right in the middle, she's right in the prime age for this kind of thing. My daughter Sophia, I told you the story about, she's now a nun in Greece. You know, her whole life is devoted to the worship of Christ. So, I mean, so maybe there's people out there that have, sadly, have become involved with the occult, and they might say it all started with Harry Potter. A, I have a hard time believing it, and B, if it's sad but true, I can also say that other people have been edified and encouraged to go on to greater things in their worship of Christ.
We're going to take another break now. We'll be back after this moment to continue this topic, as I raise another concern that's been raised by some. I'm Nick Peters, the Deeper Waters Podcast. We'll be back after this break.
Hey, this is Minister Grock. Thanks for listening. Although Grock Radio is free, there are costs to upkeep the website, podcast, and purchase Bibles and materials for street ministry. And while we are happy to pay this ourselves out of pocket, we will gladly accept any gifts if you feel led to support the shows and our street ministry. You can send a gift or love offering through our website at cyiworldwide.com. Thanks for your support, and God bless.
And we're back here with Hogwarts professor John Granger, and I'd like to remind people that, yes, this is listener-supported, so please support Blog Talk Radio, and please support what I'm doing here directly at Deeper Waters. You can go to my blog at deeperwaters.wordpress.com, and you can find out how to donate there. You can make a donation to us through the Ratio Christi Issues and Answers team as well. That's my chapter of Ratio Christi, defending Ratio Christi on the Internet. Now, we got John Granger here, a Hogwarts professor, and another concern that's been raised by some people, and this doesn't come out in the books, but J.K. Rowling said later on, is Dumbledore. That when making a movie, that she said, Dumbledore is a homosexual. And it's like, well, that's problematic right there. What's your thoughts on that one?
Well, let's discuss the whole thing here. She said she was. They were talking about the movie, and they wanted to introduce something like a girlfriend for Dumbledore. They wanted to have some sort of, Dumbledore winking at women or something like that. And she wrote a note, which she slid to the producer, that said, "No, Dumbledore is gay." Now, this came out when she gave her open book tour after Deathly Hallows came out. And she was giving a huge talk at, I think it was Carnegie Hall, with Stephen King and some other writers. They were reading from their works, but it's basically the Joanne Rowling show. Everybody was there to see Joanne Rowling. They had big prizes and big contests, where the prize was tickets in Carnegie Hall to see Joanne Rowling. And one of my friends, Dr. Amy Sturgis, was there. And she said what happened was a woman came to the microphone to ask her question and told her story. And it was largely about how she was misunderstood as a young person and that Harry Potter helped her get through all of those things. And it was implied somehow that she was homosexual and that she wasn't accepted by her parents and such. Well, the whole room was just silent because this woman was just pouring out her heart to Joanne Rowling to thank her for helping her get through a rough time in her life with these magnificent stories. And then she asked about Dumbledore. She said, did Dumbledore ever know love? Did Dumbledore ever know love? And Rowling's response, which brought the house down, it being New York, of all places, and Harry Potter fans, as a rule, lean hard to the left politically and to the secular spiritual spectrum. Agnostic at best is almost a given for serious Harry Potter groups like Harry Potter Alliance and stuff. And so when Rowling said out loud, I've always thought Dumbledore is gay, the house came down. She told the story about how she had to tell the producer this so that Dumbledore wouldn't be shown with a girlfriend. This being the United States at the end of times, the next day, I'm told, there were T-shirts on the streets of New York being sold that said, I'm a gay wizard, But remember, Rowling immediately, almost immediately, began to backtrack from her comment. Now, she had said this largely as a token to this woman who she assumed, I think, had same-sex attraction issues, whatever. But then she, in an interview with a young Scot back home in Edinburgh, she said that Dumbledore certainly was attracted to Grindelwald, but that he had not acted on it, and he was so alarmed at the consequences of his infatuation with this friend that he never acted on this, that he basically retired to the school and became, you know, a recluse, you know, and an abstinent person, which is exactly what Christians who are afflicted with same-sex attraction, which is not affected positively by therapy or something like that, that they live with that affliction, but they don't act on it. Now, I mean, this is about, I mean, when Rowling said this, I was astonished because she is so politically correct. She is so supportive of homosexual causes and things like that. Now, for her to come out and pretty much say Dumbledore was an abstinent person who had this thing, she was essentially saying that he understood it as an affliction. He didn't understand it as something that he should be marching in the streets in pride about. And that every single character in the story that's in relationship is heterosexual and is married. Marriage in the wizarding world and divorce is almost unknown. So even adultery is almost unknown except among the dark wizards. So, I mean, for anyone to say, oh, see, Dumbledore is gay, he's the headmaster, clearly these books are not setting a positive example, isn't aware of the backstory to the Dumbledore is gay quotation, and isn't aware of the stories themselves all being about heterosexual love in marriage, and that sex outside of marriage, while suggested, is never portrayed and is not considered to be, I mean, the fact that marriage is still held up as the goal and the end, it's very difficult to make the argument that these books are anything but small-o orthodox, while still being realistic enough that people can recognize, you know, the world in which they live. This is not Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm or it's not an Adventure and Odyssey, you know, radio drama. This is, you know, while it's mythic and it has a lot of archetypal elements and symbols in it, it is much more down to earth, maybe even earthy than, say, a Chronicles of Narnia story is. You're not going to find booger jokes in The Lord of the Rings. You're not going to find, you know, Uranus jokes in the Chronicle of Narnia. This is a rather earthy schoolboy novel. But given those parameters, it's remarkably faithful to a Christian understanding of relationships.
Yeah, I remember when I worked at the Christian Research Institute, we were talking about someone who was reviewing books and saying, you did think there are four of occult references, and said, these books are very, very dark, and kept using the word dark over and over. And we were talking amongst ourselves and saying, well, of course they're dark in many cases, because in the books, evil is portrayed in the way it really is.
That's right. Rowling was accused of the books getting too dark, that they're getting more and more horrific. And she said, well, you know, the books start off with a double murder and an orphan, you know. That's in the first chapter, we find out that Lily and James Popper have been killed by this thing. And it ends with this horrible moment of this, the guy's head, the face in the back of his head. And, it's a nightmare scene. She says, how does it get much more horrific than that? But as you said, of course the fifth, sixth, and seventh books are horrific. The Dark Lord is back. The whole world is under siege. I mean, can you imagine if they made that, it was all a friendly, happy story? I mean, yeah. It wouldn't be honest to the struggle that we're in. The book, I mean, I think one of the big parts of the story that are hard for Christians like us to understand is that we've grown up on stories like The Lord of the Rings and The Chronicles of Narnia. And those stories, they are fairly straightforward Christ figures. For example, you get, in Final Fantasy IX, obviously you've got Aslan, who is, you know, a fairly, even though Lewis denied that he was a symbol of Christ, he was more of a what if the Word took a different form in the world. I mean, sort of a what-if possibility. But for us, it's largely, you know, the Christ of this world is Aslan. You know, if you know him here, then you can know him better in your own world or whatever, as he says at the end of Voyage of the Dawn Treader. That figure is, you know, if you're looking for that in Harry Potter, he's not there. You know, Dumbledore's a nice guy. He's got all sorts of issues. He's not Aslan, right? I mean, Rowling said that in a famous interview with Lev Grossman. You know, Dumbledore is not Jesus. I mean, he's a Christ figure in many ways, but he is not Jesus. Now, when you go to the Lord of the Rings, now there you find there's three fairly obvious Christ figures that represent Christ as high priest, as king, and as sacrifice. You know, the high priest Christ is Gandalf. You know, he dies to save them in the caves, underneath the mines of Moria. And he comes back to life, right? He sacrifices himself in love and saves them, and he comes back to life. Next, we have the king himself, Strider. Aragorn, who goes underneath the mountain, you know, he scourges hell. He comes out with these spirits that have been condemned to this hell, and he brings them out, he cleans out hell, and he frees them, right? But he has to die himself in a way in order to do that. He has to throw his life, you know, basically under the bus to save the world, and he does. And he rises from the dead and defeats the people there before Gondor. Now, and the last and probably the most important one, of course, is Frodo, who is the sacrifice. He actually has to go up to the mountain and be ready to throw himself in with the ring. You know, fortunately, there's Gollum there to bite off his finger when he's not equal to it. There in the middle of nowhere. But he and Sam are on the rock, just waiting to be taken down into the lava, whatever, and before the eagles come to save them, they're there as sacrifice, and it was worth it, you know? Sam's saying, this is going to be a great story, you know, about Sam and Frodo. You know, if you want to cry, just thinking about it. But there we see those three aspects of Christ, this high priest, king, and sacrifice, in a relatively transparent, you know? I mean, that Aragorn's, you know, being the king, who has the magical abilities with the healing and stuff like that, you know, all of those things are relatively, transparent. You can see Christ right through that figure. When you get to Harry Potter, it's not like that. What you get instead of an Aslan figure or a heroic, dramatic demonstration of things like Christ had done, what you get instead is what's usually known as a Christian everyman story. Now, a Christian everyman story is somebody, you know, in the medieval drama, it is a guy whose name is Everyman, and he stands for everybody. And this generic figure makes choices that are all allegorical choices, and he has experiences which are all allegorical experiences on the way to his salvation. I mean, basically the Pilgrim's Progress storyline. In Harry Potter, you have that. In fact, Harry Potter's name means the heir of the Potter. If you Google Potter Christianity, what you find are all the Potter's House churches that are named after those passages in Scripture which refer to God as the Potter, the shaper of the human vessel, right? I mean, that God shapes us the way that the Potter shapes a pot on the wheel. Now, that Harry Potter is the heir of the Potter, and that he is meant to be this generic person who finds himself basically alone in the world, and he has to make choices. And these choices are going to make things that bring him closer to God, or I should say, you know, more able to resist and to fight the Dark Lord, who is his great enemy. And if he fights and resists the Dark Lord in that way, then he'll eventually know the power of love, which will allow him to transcend not only the bad guy, but transcend death itself, which is exactly what happened to Harry Potter.
Isn't a great example of this? We only got about 5 minutes to our next break, so you can sum up quickly. Isn't a great example of this at the end of Chamber of Secrets?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's when I really knew that the author... I thought to myself, gosh, if the author was getting all these objections about Christianity, this is the answer. Because here we have a story. It's like the everyman drama, like you said. He's down in the Chamber of Secrets. He calls on, you know, this power against the Dark Lord. In comes a phoenix, which is usually called the resurrection bird, with you know, the sword of faith, as it were, and he fights what? He fights a giant serpent. You know, not especially opaque imagery there, right? He fights this demonic image or whatever, and sure enough, you know, he defeats the thing with the tools that he's given, with the faith that he has, and he rises from this underground chamber, this hell, on the wings of the because of the magic powers of the phoenix he saves. You know, I mean, all those things about trusting in Christ and the phoenix song saving him, filling his heart with joy and filling the heart of the Dark Lord with dread, all of those are signs and symbols of the Holy Spirit, right? And Rowling writes this up just like an allegorical drama, so that if you see it, you just kind of slap your head and say, oh, my goodness, that's magnificent. And if you missed it, you still get the edifying experience, but your imagination has been baptized.
And not only that, he goes down there to rescue Ginny, whose name would refer to virginity, purity. He goes down there to get his purity.
Well, I mean, this was what I said in my first book. After the book was published, she came out and said, Ginny's real name is Ginevra, which is a different form of Guinevere. It has more to do with Harry Potter being the Arthurian legend or whatever. But certainly all of us who read the stories the first time think of Virginia, as you said. And he goes down to basically save this pure-hearted and righteous person from the Dark Lord.
And we can look at the end of a series and see that pure-hearted person, in fact, becomes his bride later on.
Well, after your break, we'll talk about, I mean, every single book, Harry dies and rises from the dead in the presence of the symbol of Christ.
Okay. Well, we'll go ahead and we'll take early our last break then. And when we come back, we'll wrap things up. I'm Nick Peters. This is the Deeper Waters Podcast. We'll be back after this break.
Oh, yeah. Hey, folks, it's Will ZPI. And you guys got to check out CYIWorldwide.com. Home of the Grok Show, free MP3s, music, advice, and even prayer support. That again is CYIWorldwide.com. Check it out.
I'm Nick Peters, and this is the Deeper Waters Podcast, being the best in Christian apologetics. We got John Granger on here talking about looking at a pop culture icon through a Christian worldview, and that's Harry Potter, which he says actually comes from a Christian worldview. And if there's anything that's central to the Christian worldview, it's the death and resurrection of Jesus. If that stone falls, everything else crumbles. If it remains, it's all true. So you're saying the death and resurrection shows up in the books bountifully, right?
Every single book. I've had people say to me, do you think this was intentional, John? And there are almost two sure things that show that almost everything in these books is intentional. One is the very involved ring structure of the series and of each individual book. And we'll talk about that in a minute if you want. But there's no way that structure is accidental. There's just too much design and all the parallels inside the series.
What do you mean by a ring structure?
Well, we'll come back to that.
Okay.
Another point that we know this book is designed to deliver this message is that in every single book, at the end of the story, Harry confronts the bad guys. He winds up either one-on-one facing down the bad guys or with a couple of his friends. And in that confrontation, Harry loses. Almost always, he's in a situation where he says something very close to or exactly like, this is what it's like to die. You know, or, excuse me, he has a, you know, what you might call a faux death, F-A-U-X death, a near-death experience, if you will. And when, you get to the point when he says that in the latter books, you're like, oh, good, Harry's going to make it, because every other time he said that in the books, he makes it. Well, what happens in each one of the books is there's an arrival on the scene of a symbol of Christ. And Harry, from his near death, rises from the dead to either just escape or to vanquish the Dark Lord. In the first book, it's the Philosopher's Stone. The Philosopher's Stone exudes what they call the Elixir of Life, which has always been considered to be a cipher or a symbol of communion in the body and blood of Christ. And it gives you eternal life and riches. The riches are, of course, the spiritual riches rather than gold, but it's gold in terms of it being solid light. That's the whole alchemical thing. The second thing, we get the phoenix again. We get the phoenix the first time, I should say. That we talked about before, where Fox the Phoenix shows up, the resurrection bird comes, and everything is transformed because Harry makes this statement of faith in Dumbledore versus the Dark Lord of goodness over evil. In the third book, we get the Patronus, which is a stag. Now, that white stag Patronus is interesting because in icons of St. Godric of Belgium, and of course, you recognize Godric because of Godric Gryffindor. St. Godric, his familiar in the thing is the white stag. And the white stag is considered a symbol of Christ, very much like the unicorn is. But it's considered especially a symbol of Christ because the rack of a stag will come off. You know, he'll shed that rack. And shedding that rack, and then it will grow back, much like something being reborn. And people often consider that racks would have crosses embedded in them. Then we get to, so that's what saves him from the, I'm going to blank here.
From the Dementors.
That's right, at the end of Prisoner of Azkaban. Then Goblet of Fire, we see the Phoenix again, right? The Phoenix song comes out of the golden sphere, which contains Harry and the Dark Lord again. And we get Phoenix song, which has the same effect on the newly incarnated Dark Lord, as it did on the memory image of the Dark Lord in Chamber of Secrets. And again, Harry is saved and escapes with his life. Then there's Order of the Phoenix, in which a fox comes down again to save Albus Dumbledore, who's protecting Harry from the Dark Lord. Only the fact that Fox flies in and swallows the death curse and dies right there and rises from the dead right there in front of Harry, does Harry survive that scene? Of course, Harry still dies a near death there when the Dark Lord takes over his body. But he rises from that dead thing again. Well, then in the last book,
You left out book six, Half-Blood Prince.
Half-Blood Prince comes out, and sure enough, Harry is chasing Snape out of Hogwarts, and he's being blasted. He's being basically, he's all but being murdered by Snape and his henchmen when who flies in but?
Fox.
The Hippogriff. Fox. The Hippogriff comes in and says, now the Hippogriff is a symbol of Christ because the Hippogriff is actually three animals, right? It's a horse, the hippo, and it's a griffin. And the griffin is half eagle and half lion. And the griffin, we get in Gryffindor. Gryffindor literally means in French the golden lion, and is a reference to the end of Dante's Purgatorio, where the golden griffin is the eagle's, the lion's body and the eagle's wings, and it comes, draws the chariot, which brings Beatrice, that purifies Dante and allows him into paradise. Well, this same golden griffin appears here, Buckbeak appears, and saves Harry from Snape, chases Snape out of Hogwarts. Again, a symbol of Christ appears right at Harry's desperation moment of need, and he survives to fight another day. And in the last of course, Harry becomes really his own symbol of Christ. He, by his choosing to die, he has no idea that his blood and the Dark Lord are the same, and that if he sacrifices himself without resistance, then he'll be protected again by the blood of his mother, the love of his mother. He doesn't know that. All he knows is that he learns in the Pensieve what Snape's memories tell him, and that is that he has to die. He has to be like a lamb to slaughter. he has to go. Yeah, he escapes with a pig to slaughter. He has to basically go out, and he does. He marches out to the Forbidden Forest in the company of a host of a cloud of witnesses or whatever. Because of the Resurrection Stone, he has his mother and father and Sirius and Lupin there with him until the last minute, and then he's by himself and he sacrifices himself. Well, and of course he rises from he has his tête-à-tête with Dumbledore in King's Cross Station. He rises from that death, and of course because he's risen from the dead here, and he knows where the Dark Lord is going. He no longer fears the Dark Lord. He knows where the Dark Lord is in that train station, right? I mean, he calls him to repentance. He calls him to feel a little remorse there. He's become this image of Christ himself. And it's finally he's realized the power of love, that this power of love, which is the fabric of reality, which is God's word and his love. But when he realizes the power of that, and if he identifies entirely with that, trusting everything to that, trusting that this is even greater than death, that if he loves his friend so much and denies himself, right, just forgets himself into conform to that love, then he will win. And sure enough, he does. He knows what the wand cores are, because the wand cores are also all symbols of Christ, and Harry rises from the dead again. And the Dark Lord, of course, is vanquished. Harry's become the center of the circle, and the Dark Lord is peripheral, and they circle around each other, and of course the Dark Lord loses. So that repetition, every single book, giving us that storyline of near death, and then symbol of Christ, and then resurrection, and fight another day. And then until finally Harry gets the message himself, and literally becomes this Christian everyman that dies and rises again. That's a powerful, powerful story. It's one of, I don't think people appreciate Deathly Hallows that much as a story, but we've seen two other really popular series recently come to a conclusion. We've seen Hunger Games, which I think is a magnificent series. I mean, both these series I'm going to talk about, I think, are magnificent. The Divergent Trilogy by Victoria Roth, and the... I think I just mispronounced her name. It'd be Veronica Roth. That series and the Hunger Games books both have very difficult endings. The trilogies and the last book really upsets people as a rule, because things happen in those books that just blow your mind. They seem to come out of left field. The Harry Potter series, in contrast, because they were designed from the back to the end, from the back to the beginning, all the story led up to what she was looking to do in Deathly Hallows. So she spent 5 years planning it so that the ending would be a wow, it would be a great thing. That's a tremendous achievement, so that all of the deaths that Harry has coming up to Deathly Hallows are really just our preparation for the experience of Harry's sacrificial death and rising from the dead, and victory over the Dark Lord in Deathly Hallows.
It could also be that's the only book where really much of a Christian terminology is made explicit, such as in the graveyard, you find the tombstone has, and the last enemy to be defeated is death. There was an atheist, I don't remember, I think Lee Grossman, remember his name, who said, if you want to know who dies in Harry Potter, it's God. And this was right before the last book came out, and there in the last book, there was a Bible verse on a tombstone.
Yeah, well, I mean, Lev Grossman's a good friend of mine, and he's very embarrassed about the things that he wrote about Harry Potter before the best book came out. I mean, he didn't like Deathly Hallows very much for a lot of reasons, but you're right. Although I kind of groaned myself when I first read the graveyard scene, because Harry, reading the thing, says about St. Paul's comment, the last people to be destroyed, the last thing to be destroyed would be death. Harry says, that sounds like something a Death Eater would say. I thought, oh, great. You know, Harry Potter finally reads a little scripture on a rock, and he says, St. Paul's a Death Eater. That's great. You know, the Harry haters are going to love that. But you're right. I mean, of course, that and the quotation from the Sermon on the Mount that's on the other gravestone there, Rowling says, I think actually misspeaking, but she says it epitomizes the meaning of the entire book. I think she meant that it illustrated. She said that there were four things that really reveal the meaning of the story, and one of them is just that, which you said, is the fact that there's scripture on these stones and that there are meditations there. They're right in the heart of the story. It's Christmas Eve, and the church's shadow, if you will. They're reflecting on their own mortality. I mean, it's really the heart of the book. Harry's wand is broken. His faith in Dumbledore is broken at that point. And they're right in the heart of it, in that darkest moment before Christ comes into the world, right? Christmas Eve. Harry encounters the scripture. You know, and that scripture on the tombstone from the Sermon on the Mount, which is just before, you know, where your treasure is, there your heart will be also, on Ariana Dumbledore's tomb. Dumbledore is the only one who actually reads scripture. I'm confident he chose the scripture citations for both of those headstones. Passage where he says, "Where your treasure is, there your heart will be also," is right before that part of the Sermon on the Mount about eyes. I'll have to come back and talk to you about eyes. That's a 90-minute lecture or whatever. But all the eyes in there are about transformed vision, which bring us back to that passage and what Christ says about the singularity of the eye. If the eye in you is single, then your whole body would be filled with life. If the eye within you is evil, being contrasted with single is double or whatever, then the light within you is darkness, and how great is that darkness? So those lines there are important because we have single eyes inside the book. We have the eye of Mad-Eye Moody, which plays a very important role, especially in Harry's decision to bury it and make a sign of the cross on the tree. And you have the two eyes of the Dark Lord in the passage where Ron is purified in the forest. If you want to read about that, please, there's a book called Deathly Hallows Lectures that I wrote that has, a really long passage about, a really long chapter about C.S. Lewis's ideas of eyes and how it plays out in the five eyes of Deathly Hallows, including Deathly Hallows symbols, which Rowling calls an eye several times. But what I really want to get to is how we know these books are designed this way is because of their ring structure. Now, that ring structure is, you can go to lulu.com and buy my book that has all of the charts and notes on this or whatever. But what we find when we look at Harry Potter is there's a traditional structure that Christians know because of something called chiasmus. Now, it's a commonplace in Christian scripture that the end and the beginning will match up, and that if there's a longest passage that you can very often in the passage inside the larger text or even the text as a whole, you can draw it as a circle or as a key if you want, and you can see that the end and the beginning match up, that there's a turning point or the heart of the passage, and then there's parallels going out and coming back to that center, or that turning point. So if you do it in a linear fashion, you'd say it was A, B, C, D, and then you'd go back and it'd be C, B, A, and we'd close the circle there where the A would come back like that. Mm-hmm. Now, that structure is called chiasmus, and again, it's a commonplace not only in Scripture, but in epic poetry, in medieval drama, Chinese novel, Tristram Shandy. There's a wonderful book called Thinking in Circles by the anthropologist Mary Douglas, where she argues cogently that this is the universal story form that only dies out in the 18th century. She's wrong about that. C.S. Lewis, Charles Williams, Tolkien, everybody uses this today. I mean, Rowling uses it. But when you look at the Harry Potter novels, what you find out is that every single one of her books and the series as a whole are organized on just this structure. And we can be pretty sure about where she gets it from because Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone, the original title, is a 17-chapter novel that has its story turn in Chapter 9. Well, there's another 17-story book, the first book in a 7-book series, that is also 17 chapters long. It turns in Chapter 9, and it's The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. They're almost exactly paralleled and having parallel structures. Lewis gets it from Charles Williams, almost certainly. The Place of the Lion and these things are Ring novels. And certainly, it shouldn't be any surprise that The Hobbit is, because, you know, Tolkien even names his most famous series The Lord of the Rings. I mean, they're consumed by circular story structures. Rowling is a great fan of Lewis and Tolkien, and someone who actually loves patterns. She's pattern obsessed. One of the things people don't know about Rowling is that she's one of the world's greatest players of a game called Minesweeper. You ever heard about that? If you've got Microsoft, Office or whatever, I think it comes on the games that come in there, and Rowling has played the expert board there and done the expert board in less than 99 seconds, which puts her in the top 20 in the world. Now, if you played the game Minesweeper, you realize that almost all of it is intuitive pattern recognition. I mean, you have to get a great jump on the board by getting a bunch of the holes in the board if you're going to do that well. But then you have to have a remarkable sense of, you can't be thinking about where the mine might be. If you're going to be going that fast, you have to intuitively understand pattern. And Rowling is there with that. Every one of her books is laid out so that the first chapter, the last chapters, and the middle chapter are going to resonate and be the heart of the story. And then the chapters going out on each side, going out to the turning point and then coming back from the turning point, are going to be in parallel, so that you'll see, every when Ron and Harry are on the train in Philosopher's Stone, and they meet each other and they talk about their families and such, the chapter opposite it, if you draw the book as a circle, the chapter opposite that chapter is Harry and Ron in front of the Mirror of Erised, where they see their family. They see their relationship with their families laid out. It's almost like there's a question and then there's a response. I mean, and it really gets to be really funny when you see what it's like. In Order of the Phoenix, we have Sirius Black's mother being in this painting behind a curtain. And you have this crazy black female relation behind a curtain, and she's dead. And then the chapter opposite it, of course, is where Sirius is blown through the curtain by a insane female relation, and he dies. Okay? Mm-hmm. You see these kind of mirrored reflections in stories back and forth. Right?
John, we've only got a couple of minutes left. So before we go, though, I do want to remind people, next week I got J.P. Holding coming on talking about Hitler's Christianity, but I'd like you to just, some of the people tell us where we can find out more, because we only got a couple minutes left. I'm not sure you'd have enough time to finish your last point. So if people want to find out more about what you're saying, where do they go?
Well, you can go right to Amazon.com. And if you order a book called How Harry Casts His Spell, that's the Tim Dale book. It has all the explanation of the Christian artistry and meaning of the Hogwarts saga. All of a sudden I'm talking about there, except for the ring composition, is in How Harry Casts His Spell. A book that talks a great deal about, how this all comes together in Deathly Hallows, which is still the fastest-selling book of all time, as well as one of the best-selling books of all time, is the Deathly Hallows Lectures, which is a book I wrote about Deathly Hallows alone. And most important, perhaps, you should go to my website, hogwartsprofessor.com, and just search through the archives there, because you'll find hundreds and hundreds of articles about Christian meaning of not only these books, but of books like The Hunger Games, the Twilight book, the Divergent Trilogy, and you can read about them there.
Okay. Well, we're getting ready to wrap things up, but John, I want to thank you for being my guest on the show today. I hope you've enjoyed yourself, and I hope the listeners out there have learned something about reading this kind of literature.
But you're very kind, and I'm sorry about my coming in so late. I, I was all excited about this, and I looked at your email, and I thought, oh, I've got an hour here. And then, oh, no, now I'm 10 minutes late. Thank you for being so gracious about my coming in as
nope.
a tardy special guest here.
No problem. It happens. This is Nick Peters here. I'm signing off. Next week, we're going to be talking about Hitler's Christianity. See you next week.